Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam, hello, bonjour, welcome to the Majlis. I'm your host, Adnan Hussein. And in today's episode, I'm joined by a friend and colleague, Dr. Jasmine Zine. She is professor of sociology and Muslim studies at Wilfrid Laurier University. She's the author of the forthcoming book, tentatively entitled Under Siege, Islamophobia and the 9/11 Generation. It's based on a six-year study funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, and she's also currently working on another SHRC-funded study mapping the Canadian Islamophobia industry. As a result, she's really the perfect guest to speak with us just ahead of the fourth anniversary of the tragic killing of six and wounding of 19 worshippers at the Islamic Cultural Center of Quebec in Sainte-Foy, Quebec City. To discuss the consequences and lessons of that terrible event and to examine the serious continuing problem of Islamophobia in Quebec, Canada, and beyond. Jasmine, salam, greetings. Thank you for joining me today.
Walaikum salam. It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Not at all. It's wonderful to have you to talk about a subject that's very difficult and painful to remember and to think about, but I think one that is necessary that we really recall and remember. So I'm wondering if perhaps you could first just remind us of what happened 4 years ago in Quebec City on January 29th, and we can talk a little bit about the effects and consequences.
Yeah, certainly. And I agree that this is something that we need to every year reflect on and commemorate. So January 29th, 2017 has to be remembered as the date of the worst mass murder to take place in a house of worship in Canada's history. And that was the day when six Muslim men were shot dead after their evening prayers in the Quebec City mosque. And it's important to, I think, remember who these men were. And they were a local halal grocery store owner, a professor at the University of Laval, three civil servants, and a pharmacy worker. They came originally from Morocco, Algeria, and Guinea. They were fathers, sons, husbands, brothers, respected members of the local community. Their names were Ibrahima Barry, who was age 39, Mamadou Tanou Bari, age 42, Khalid Belkassimi, age 60, Abu Bakr Tabti, age 44, Abdul Karim Hassan, age 41, and Azadine Soufian, age 57. So when we think back to that tragic massacre which happened at the mosque, and think about where the responsibility lies for a tragedy like this. There's many places that we need to look to account for why something like this happened. But if we look first at the white nationalist terror that took place and the perpetrator of that act, Alexandre Bissonnette, who at the time was a 26-year-old anthropology student at the University of Laval. And what we know about what was going on in his world and prior to the terrible shooting was that he was browsing websites that were linked to white nationalists and certain alt-right ideologues like Robert Spencer. He was looking at the former Ku Klux Klan leader, David Duke, Dylan Roof, another white supremacist who gunned down 9 African-American worshipers at a South Carolina church. And also, of course, Marc Lépine, the shooter in Montreal's 1989 L'École Polytechnique massacre. In addition to that, he made about 800 online searches of former US President Donald Trump. But later, Bissonnette confessed to the police that he'd been motivated by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's message of welcome to Syrian refugees coming to Canada, and also following Donald Trump's travel ban on 7 Muslim majority countries. And he was someone who was also had fallen prey to that myth of Muslim invaders coming into Canada, and this idea of Muslims as a kind of Trojan horse that are going to take over the country and institute Sharia law. These are some of the kinds of conspiracy theories that circulate widely. And there's evidence to show that this was part of his thinking in terms of what motivated him to go out that cold evening on January 27th and gun down these six men while they were in prayer, and of course also injuring 19 others in that brutal attack. Which is something that affected, to some extent all Canadians, but had a profound effect on the Muslim community and still does to this day.
Indeed. I had the, at your suggestion, I watched a documentary episode of The Gem called The Mosque, A Community Struggle from, I believe, 2019. That really tried to document the consequences and effects on that local Muslim community in Quebec City. And it really showed that it had a lot of effects that we wouldn't necessarily consider beyond just the cataclysmic loss of life. But one thing I was impressed by was how much they were struggling to get to a sense of normality, and how difficult that was in the particular context of the political environment, the ongoing trial. Under those conditions, it seemed that in some ways they felt very abandoned by political leaders in Quebec and ignored and marginalized by Quebec society. And I wondered if you could comment a little bit further on the toll that this has taken and the specifics of the environment in Quebec and how it affected Muslims and does continue to affect Muslims in the province.
Yes, I think in that documentary was the first to really take stock of the survivors of this tragedy and look at what life's been like for them in the aftermath of the massacre, and how they are rebuilding and how they are banding together and trying to move forward with their lives. And it was very powerful and poignant to hear them speak about that sense of feeling forgotten, that, you know, politicians and had kind of abandoned them. Nothing has sort of come of this tragedy. And I think that that is a sentiment that probably a lot of Muslims also share. One of the things that emerged in the aftermath of that tragedy was Motion 103, which was tabled by Ikra Khalid, a Liberal MP. And that motion in the aftermath of the Quebec massacre was put forward and passed to recognize the saliency of Islamophobia in Canada as something that needs to be documented, researched, combated, and addressed. You know, it's fairly simple in its formulation, and yet it was met with so much virulent hate and pushback. Ikra Khalid, who had tabled the motion, in 1 week, she received about 50,000 hate emails that were quite vile, racist, and involved direct threats of violence to her. And so when we think of this happening in the aftermath of this time where the Muslim community was still mourning this tragedy, and then to be bombarded with all of this hate that was coming, and all of the pushback and resistance to Motion 103, it tells us that there are strong undercurrents of anti-Muslim racism and Islamophobia in Canada, and, you know, which is something that we knew, but it was another illustration of how deeply that undercurrent runs that even in the face of this massacre, there was still a lot of Islamophobia happening. And in fact, hate crimes were even escalating in Quebec around that time. You had denial from French Premier Legault, who was saying that, you know, Islamophobia doesn't exist in Quebec. And, you know, he later backtracked to say, well, it does, but it's not really widespread. So, you know, and that was in response to proposals to commemorate January 29th as a national day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia. And so he shut down that, you know, groundswell of calls to have this day of commemoration with that response that, well, we don't have Islamophobia in Quebec, it's not a problem. And so, you know, when we think of that and we think, you know, prior to that tragic event, a year earlier at the same mosque, a pig's head had been left at the door with a sign that said Bon Appetit. You know, so there were precursors to that event happening even at that same mosque. There has been a long history in Quebec and in Canada broadly, but especially in Quebec, of Islamophobia, both systemically through many iterations of bills to ban Islamic attire in the public sphere, everything from Bill 94 more than a decade ago, and now we have Bill 21.
Right.
So this banning of, you know, religious attire, but specifically tends to target Muslim women wearing hijab, niqab, all of these references to, you know, Islamic sartorial choices that are being regulated, disciplined, policed, and outlawed in the public sphere, you know, are part of that gendered Islamophobia that's been institutionalized, you know, in Quebec. You know, prior to that, there was all of the debates on reasonable accommodation that were happening, and many of those flashpoints and involved situations where there were questions about how to integrate Muslims and their religious practices into the secular society in Quebec. And if you recall, there was even that town of Héroville, about 200 miles from Montreal, that set up a citizens code or a town charter, you know, that was a kind of discursive fortress that they created to keep out of their community, which was a very homogeneous sort of white Catholic rural community that didn't have any diversity in it, and, you know, ethno-racial diversity or cultural religious diversity in the first place, but to ensure that that would not encroach on their society. And so creating that town charter. And so there have been a lot of deeply rooted seeds of Islamophobia in Quebec that led up to this particular attack. So the seeds had been sown already, and then this tragedy, you know, emerged through that trajectory.
Yes. Well, you know, what's interesting is you review those precursors and also the consequences of the terrible event itself. I'm most impressed by how resilient a culture of denial of Islamophobia is in the political and cultural discourse of Quebec. It seems that it would be very hard to deny that there was Islamophobia, a form of bigotry that clearly manifested in this terrible killing and massacre of Muslims at prayer in a mosque. And yet the premier is able to very soon after deny that there's any Islamophobia in Quebec, and after some pushback, as you pointed out, adjusting it moderately. But it seems that there's something particularly strong in the kind of cultural and political matrix of Quebec that is asserting a denial of Islamophobia. And when you mentioned Bill 21, of course, it's not, it's targeting forms of religious dress or symbols of religious identity. But of course, the bill is titled Bill 21, an act respecting the laïcité of the state. And I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on what's particular and unique about this context in Quebec before we start talking a little bit more broadly again about the Canadian situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, this, you know, ever since the Quiet Revolution and these notions of laïcité, which are also mirroring, you know, what we see happening in France and in very, very virulent ways where religious rights are being sacrificed on this altar of secularism, you know, and in Quebec, a lot of the charter challenges to Bill 21 are pointing out how this contravenes the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And so you have these sort of clashing ideals. And in Quebec, they are, I think, a product of that Quiet Revolution, this idea of secularism. But it seems to really fixate particularly upon Muslims. And so there's something deeper to that in terms of the type of Islamophobia that has manifest there and that we still see today, you know, very unabashedly, really. I mean, very recently, too, Quebec politicians have been, you know, propagating Islamophobic rhetoric and discourse about Canadian Muslim politicians and media figures. You know, this has happened quite recently in their reference to, you know, Minister Omar Al-Ghabra, to Janela Massa, and you know, and these,
and Bushra Manai's appointment recently as commissioner in Montreal on racism and systemic discrimination.
Yes, thank you. That was the third reference that they have been particularly, you know, trying to cast again in these ways that are deeply rooted in a kind of Orientalist fantasy of the Muslim archetype as being something inherently subversive, something that, you know, is really, you know, what I've talked about in my work is a kind of civilizational danger. Right, that Muslims are posing a very civilizational danger. And when you start to look at a lot of the tropes and discourses of Islamophobia in Canada, you see that that really is where the threat is coming from. So on the one hand, you have this kind of existential threat that Muslims are seen to pose as, you know, threats in terms of the terrorist, the jihadist, and so on. There's the threat of demographic replacement. So, you know, that is a popular one, especially in Europe, but we see it also here being reproduced by a lot of white nationalist groups. So then Muslims are this demographic threat. And then also the civilizational danger that Muslims are seen to be embodying. And, you know, and that manifests through even the danger of Muslim women and as you know, the reproductive danger that Muslim women pose, the danger that Muslim women pose culturally if they are wearing Islamic attire, wearing the hijab, niqab, that this is, you know, again, its own Trojan horse bringing in, you know, Sharia law, being antithetical to Western liberalism, democracy, the rule of law. These are all the kinds of scripts and racial kinds of scripts and Orientalist ideas that are continually receiving a kind of renewed currency in the landscape, the political and cultural landscape in Canada. And they're based on a lot of these irrational fears. Like let's, you know, if we think about the niqab, for example, and the banning of niqab in Quebec, at the time that that Bill 94 was first being promoted more than a decade ago, there were really only 24 women in the entire province that actually wore the niqab. So this idea that, you know, we have to create legislation on the basis of 24 women who happen to be, you know, covering their face, you know, is it just seems ludicrous. So what is that fear? What is that, you know, need to kind of fortify society, you know, protect the old stock Canadians and protect, you know, the pure Quebec? You know, it goes back to a kind of cultural eugenics that we are seeing taking place, in which Canadian legislation and Quebec's provincial policies are enacting.
Indeed, I think you're absolutely right in that analysis that Islam and Muslims are uniquely configured as a challenge to liberal, democratic society and play a particular role in the fears and fantasies of our society and its culture. And I'm glad also that you broadened your analysis to encompass these deeper structures or patterns of culture and history, because oftentimes when there are discussions of Bill 21 or, of course, about the Quebec City Mosque Massacre, these are characterized outside the province of Quebec as uniquely Quebec problems, but you're pointing to the fact that there are shared conditions that are relevant also for understanding the significance of Islamophobia in Canada more broadly. So I'm thinking a little bit about the fact that on the first year anniversary of the massacre, you wrote a piece in The Conversation listing five lessons to learn from this tragic event, not just for Quebec, but for Canadian society as a whole. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, at that moment, what you thought the lessons were and where we're at with any of these. It's been 4 years now since the event. What kind of progress or lack of progress do you see in Canada as a whole?
Yeah, sure. So to reflect on those lessons that I wrote about in the aftermath of the Quebec massacre, the first one that I talked about, which I think is, you know, I think all of them actually are still salient. It's not as if we've learned from these lessons and moved on, unfortunately, but they continue, if we reflect on them, they continue to teach us something about the present moment and the history that brought us here. The first lesson that I had outlined was what I called the alibi of white exceptionalism. And what prompted me to think about that was the fact that the first person that was actually detained for the Quebec shooting was a Moroccan man, Mohamed Belkader. And, you know, he had actually been at the mosque. He was when the attack happened, and he went to speak to the police when they arrived, but was detained as a suspect. And you know, and the media, particularly a lot of the right wing and far right media, were immediately reporting, you know, and kind of ran with that story because it was so easy to assume that a Muslim would be a terrorist, right? Even when Muslims were the victims. And so that misidentification demonstrated to me how easily and routinely Muslims are associated with criminality and violence and terror, and how, you know, this man was very much interpolated first, right, into this discourse, and then, you know, kind of was, you know, detained and assumed to be the perpetrator of this act, when in fact it was you know, a young white man, a white nationalist. And so, you know, what that brings us to is the privilege of whiteness as the exceptionalism that allows white people to be regarded as individuals, and that their actions will not by association affect the status or safety of others from their group. So in other words, you know, there were kids who could go to school the next day who were named Alexander, just like this killer, but they wouldn't be teased, you know. Mm-hmm. After 9/11 happened, for example, my son was named, his name is Osama, you know, so he had a lot of bullying and harassment because whatever Muslims do becomes a reflection on, you know, becomes mapped onto everybody in that community or anyone who looks or is perceived to be Muslims as a product of Islamophobia. So we don't have that luxury of being seen as an individual. Whereas whiteness allows that exceptionalism that, you know, white people don't have to be, you know, will not by association be regarded in the same way as someone who has committed a crime, for example. So it's that alibi that allows the mass murderer to be the bad apple that spoils the bunch and prevents all white people from being labeled as potentially violent and criminal, even though lone white men are most typically engaged in mass shooting. And yet, all Muslims and racialized people as well must contend with being labeled in a particular way. So for Muslims, it would be labeled as potential radicals, jihadis, and threats to the nation, when even as in the case of the mosque killings, they are actually the victim, right? So this was one thing that I think was quite clear, you know, from that, you know, from the way in which the first person arrested for this crime was seen as a Muslim. The second lesson that I derived from this tragedy was that it was important to recognize that Islamophobia is homegrown. There was a lot of, rush to look sort of south of the border to, you know, come up with a reason for what would have inspired this young white nationalist terrorist to commit this act. And certainly he was inspired by the likes of Donald Trump, because he had about 800, times where he had been searching for, Trump's views. But we cannot simply look south of the border to explain Islamophobia. As we've been just talking about, there is, you know, a genealogy and history of Islamophobia that is distinctly Canadian. And so, you know, recently in the last couple of years, my research team that I've been working with some of the graduate students, we were developing fact sheets on Islamophobia in Canada for the Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University. And one of those fact sheets was distilling public opinion polls in Canada over the last two decades about Muslims in Canada, about Islamophobia. And some of those findings tell us quite a bit about public sentiment. And, you know, for example, in 2017, so the year of the attack, an Angus Reid survey found that 43% of Canadians had unfavorable views of Islam as compared to other faiths. A Leger poll in 2016 found that there was a steady decline in Francophone views of Islam since 2012, with about 48% of Quebec respondents holding negative views. So you have almost half the population in Canada and in Quebec, respectively, that have negative ideas about Muslims. And I think even very alarmingly at that time in 2017, a CBC Radio Canada poll found that one out of four Canadians, or about 23%, would favor a ban on Muslim immigration in this country. And in Quebec, that support for that ban rose to 32%.
Right, you know, and this would be in response to the reports about Trump's Muslim ban in the U.S.
Exactly. Yeah. So this was happening, at the same time. So when they asked Canadians where they stood on the idea of a Muslim ban, you had at 23% across Canada and 32% in Quebec that favored such a ban. And, you know, we saw at that time a rise in hate crimes that grew in about 253% from 2012 to 2015. So there were already conditions that were prevalent in Canada. And as we've talked about, some of the other sort of antecedents of Islamophobia in Canada that have a longer history than simply just prior to the Quebec massacre and even prior to 9/11. So the roots were there. We cannot just look south of the border for that. And so it's important to recognize, you know, the kind of Islamophobia that exists in Canada as the breeding ground for these particular kinds of actions. So the third lesson was around looking at fear and moral panic and how that gets constituted to create also this idea of Muslims as the enemy within and the new folk devils that threaten the stability of the nation. And that's a role that other ethno-racial groups in Canada have played in the past.
Right.
But this spread of Islamophobic fear and moral panic provided this ideological breeding ground for both right-wing populism and neo-fascism. And it also supports the recruitment efforts of extremist groups too, that rely on like Daesh, for example, or Al-Qaeda, that rely on Islamophobia to set the stage for attracting disaffected youth to their cause. It becomes this sort of vicious cycle. And of course, that fear and moral panic, you know, that we see being pervaded through media, and particularly we have institutions like Rebel Media in Canada that has mm-hmm. been a major purveyor of Islamophobic ideology and has birthed particular Islamophobic ideologues like Faith Goldie and Lauren Southern and Ezra Levant. But it's also in mainstream media reporting. And there's been very good studies about mainstream media in Canada and how it purveys Islamophobia. So you've got this kind of fear and moral panic that's being built, and that feeds right into to legitimate very draconian security minority policies and racial and religious profiling that, again, continue this vicious cycle of provocation and violence and the securitization, you know, of Muslims. And so that's another fear that underwrites Islamophobia. And, you know, part of the research I'm doing currently is looking at the Islamophobia industry in Canada as this network of various groups that include media outlets and white nationalist groups, individual ideologues, Muslim dissidents, religious groups, politicians, and the donors that fund this industry. And so we've been, you know, looking at how they work together and the different connections between these different players, but also at the kinds of discourses of Islamophobia that they are purveying. And we've isolated about 16 discourses of Islamophobia, and I'm not going to go into them in detail, but it's just to say that there are many of these ideas that are being reproduced in these echo chambers, that are being purveyed through various forums that this Islamophobia network puts on, conferences, books they're writing, all sorts of forms of cultural production that are reproducing very destructive narratives and conspiracy theories about Muslims. Like I've mentioned, the Islamist boogeyman, this idea that there is a Muslim Brotherhood conspiracy in Canada and that Muslim charities and organizations are all fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood, that Muslims are invaders. You know, Muslims are wolves in sheep's clothing, or this notion of taqiyya. And so there's many of these ideas, you know, that are circulating. Also, the way the Quran gets weaponized within some of these discourses to present Islam as something that is theologically violent or misogynist or irreconcilable with modernity and Judeo-Christian values.
Yes. Well, that sounds like a fantastic and informative study. We'll have to have you on to have an episode just about the Islamophobia industry, I think.
I was just referencing that in terms of the fear and moral panic, right, as being one of those lessons, and just sort of looking at some of the roots where that's coming from. So the fourth lesson was on white nationalism and the myth of Canadian exceptionalism. And so the Canadian exceptionalism part is, again, not assuming that everything that is happening in Canada has some reference south of the border. But, you know, we have about 300 white nationalist groups operating in Canada at the moment. And we've been looking at about 13 of those specifically who have where Islamophobia is their specific mandate. So, you know, when we look at this, again, homegrown Islamophobia, that's one of the expressions, or one of what we call the foot soldiers of Islamophobia, are those white nationalist groups. And there needs to be a lot more spotlight and awareness. Some of these groups, a couple of them, are already on the terrorism list in Canada, Blood and Honor and Combat 18, for example. There's now calls to get the Proud Boys on that list. But these are the groups that are kind of on the street and are getting out of the shadows of the internet chat rooms and are being far more visible in the public sphere and are working together and in concert with other players in this industry, Islamophobia industry, to perpetuate Islamophobic propaganda. And so that's another, I think, lesson that we learned from the Islamophobia, from the attack in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And I guess finally, I think the last lesson had to do with, you know, the resilience and strength and solidarity that emerged from this tragedy. And especially as you were mentioning and looking at the documentary about the mosque and the community, how it came together, despite feeling abandoned, despite, you know, the kind of national amnesia that has occurred after this tragedy. You had some really strong examples of courage and resilience. You know, if we think of how one of the men, Ayman Derbali, was paralyzed after he tried to, you know, stop the shooter. and save many lives in that process, you know. And, you know, there was a real spirit of resilience where some of the survivors joined survivors of the Montreal Polytechnique massacre mm-hmm. that occurred in 1989 in raising awareness of gun violence. And so I think that, you know, it's really important to look at that, the courage and the resilience of the community that, you know, was targeted, but that survived, and think of, I think it's important to think about how we can support them and commemorate this tragedy, because that has failed to happen to date.
Indeed. Well, I want to pick up on that. You mentioned a kind of situation of national amnesia, and we see that also portrayed in many ways in the documentary that goes up to 2019, that the first anniversary was well attended, it was significant and serious, but since that time there has been much less attention, and the day passes without a lot of serious reflection and self-reflection in Canada about this terrible tragedy. You have a piece that's coming out this week in The Conversation that really takes up this issue of the national amnesia that we're suffering and makes the case for the need to remember. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the apathy you see and the opposition to declaring it a national day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia. What is this telling us about the challenges that we're facing in really reckoning with this event and its consequences?
Yeah, I think, you know, we look at the fact that we're now at the fourth year anniversary of the Quebec massacre, and despite the efforts of grassroots community advocacy organizations, there's been no official day of commemoration designated to mark this tragedy. And, you know, I was talking earlier about Motion 103 and how also nothing has emerged concretely from Motion 103. You know, there was a public, you know, hearings that were done on Motion 103 and a report that emerged from that. And it very much sidelined Islamophobia, actually. And out of 30 recommendations, only two of them addressed Islamophobia. And one of them was to institute a national day of remembrance, but that was never picked up. You had about 70 Muslim organizations and other grassroots organizations that were advocating for this day. In Ontario, we had Rima Burns McGowan, an NDP MPP who had tabled Bill 83, which was to have a day of remembrance in Ontario, but that has still been dormant on the floor and nothing has come from that. And so it really struck me that, you know, despite the push to do this, you know, Canadians for Peace and Justice in the Middle East had hashtag January 29th as a campaign that they were running as well to have this day commemorated. And with all of these different efforts, nothing came of it. And I really was struck by that. And I see that as a kind of national amnesia, this sort of, you know, forgetting of what this tragedy had meant and should mean, you know, for the nation. And, you know, it made me think about Judith Butler's words around, you know, when she was talking in the frames of war about what bodies are grievable and the grievability mm-hmm. of certain bodies and what bodies and lives matter. And it brought me back to thinking about her words around that. Because when I think about, you know, December 6th, which was the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women that emerged after the Montreal massacre, that has been an important day in our collective memory as a nation. But for some reason, the Quebec Moss massacre failed to garner that same level of public sentiment and support, despite all these calls to commemorate the tragedy and address the Islamophobia that led to it.
Indeed. There's such a disparity between those two cases that, of course, can only be explained by the Islamophobia industry, the increasing Islamophobia in our culture. But I'm surprised also in this piece you also mention how little infrastructure or institutional development there has been outside of grassroots campaigns. even in academia, for example, in universities and academic circles, where you would expect that scholars who are dedicated to questions of social justice and combating racism and misogyny and are committed to these forms of scholarly activism, that there's been very little take-up and institutional backing for the study of Islamophobia. Perhaps you could comment a little bit on the startling absence of a real infrastructure in the universities or in the academic environment that recognizes the importance of this problem and the need for scholarly research to understand it.
Yes, thank you for raising that. I think it's really important because, you know, again, stemming from the priorities of Motion 103, which was really about documenting, researching, addressing, and combating Islamophobia, there should have been some clear directives to follow through from when it comes to, for example, priorities at the Social Sciences Research and Humanities and Research Council, or SHRC, which is a major funding body for academic research in Canada. There were no, for example, funding priorities that SHRC came out with around Islamophobia. There have been no Canada research chairs creating Islamophobia studies. There are not positions being created in the field of critical Muslim studies or in Islamophobia studies. And also, there were really no tangible measures or resources that were offered to create awareness or combat Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism that, you know, could have been facilitated through the academy, whether in developing research centers, creating positions. I teach a couple of courses on Islamophobia, but I think there's very few, these may be the only ones that I know that are being taught in Canada that are a regular part of the our program in Muslim studies. But, you know, this is something that I think is, again, part of that national amnesia, part of that willful forgetting or really sidelining of Islamophobia in the public imaginary, in the institutions, and certainly in the academy, where we've not seen this tragedy and what led up to it be reflected in the development of courses and positions and, you know, any kind of academic or research focus that would help us to better understand and combat Islamophobia in Canada.
It sounds like there's an awful lot of work left to do in these. I'm, like you, established a course in the history of Islamophobia that I developed with a colleague, Ariel Saltzman, just a few years ago. We haven't had a chance to teach it that frequently because we have so many other obligations. Typically, in the study of Islam, Muslims, the Middle East, our universities tend to be understaffed. And so being able to actually develop a full curriculum that gives the historical context, background, understanding of, you know, from a multidisciplinary perspective can be quite challenging in the curriculum in Canadian universities. And it means also that we don't have as much focus and attention on an issue of great significance politically, culturally, intellectually in our society, that the problem of Islamophobia, it's remarkably unaddressed in our curriculum. And I feel like it's also unfortunate that it doesn't seem to inhabit the same place intellectually and conceptually in species and forms of racism. If we think of racism, we think of anti-Black racism. We can think also of colonialism and its consequences on Indigenous populations. Of course, anti-Semitism is something that's widely recognized because of its deep roots in history and culture in Europe and North America. But when it comes to Islamophobia, there's if there isn't outright hostility to naming and conceiving of it as a genuine and legitimate form, as legitimately a form of discrimination that should be anathematized and combated, it's just not understood in a robust way on the same level as some of these other more recognizable and more familiar forms of prejudice and bigotry. I'm wondering what you think about that and what needs to be done to really excavate its deep roots in society, culture, and history so that it can be understood and recognized as parallel and, in fact, often intersecting with some of these other forms of racism and discrimination.
Yeah, and I think that's key in terms of really understanding how there are interlocking forms of oppression that are mutually constituting, mutually sustaining, and that they reinforce one another. And so, you know, it's important to bring Islamophobia into that understanding of the landscape of various forms of oppression. And it really doesn't get the same attention and treatment within you know, our society and our educational systems, for example, as other forms of oppression do. And yet Islamophobia is something that is quite global. You know, we have genocides that are happening in Burma around the Rohingya Muslim population there. We have, you know, the Uyghurs in China, really just beyond Orwellian proportions of what's happening to those communities there. We have virulent forms of Islamophobia in India and in Kashmir, all over. And so, you know, I try and tackle all of that in my one course on Islamophobia, as well as the history of Islamophobia. And yet it's only in these few spaces or in the course that you're teaching where students in post-secondary education have access to this kind of knowledge and information. And it really should be more widely introduced and understood, but it's absent from also our national action plan in Canada on anti-racism. A lot of our EDI policies in universities, which are equity, diversity initiatives, do not name Islamophobia as part of that. And so, you know, we cannot even really talk about the saliency of Islamophobia when the spaces for those conversations are not there, when the spaces for acknowledging the different manifestations of that oppression and how it's being enacted on different Muslim communities, there's no place to recognize that, to, you know, to talk about that and to, you know, acknowledge it. And we've not been provided with any resources from, whether it's, you know, through funding for research, whether it's through, you know, other kinds of supports and systems to actually address Islamophobia and its impact. So going right from, you know, all levels of whether we're talking about what's happening at universities or what's happening on the ground in the frontline organizations that are dealing with the impact of Islamophobia on the ground and the trauma that's being produced, there really aren't adequate resources that have been allocated in the same ways they've been allocated to deal with other forms of oppression. And there really needs to be an understanding of how those oppressions are connected and how, you know, if we are not combating all these forms of oppression, we are still allowing systems of domination and oppression to occur. And so I think this is part of my frustration with doing this kind of work, is that we are always trying, we're always having to sing for our supper. We're always having to sort of, you know, I sound like a broken record in my mind so many of the times, because I'm feeling like I have to keep putting out information about why this is important and, you know, making the case for the deep roots of Islamophobia in Canada, the consequences of that, which we've seen with the Quebec massacre, but still not, you know, seeing the commitment toward working toward that end. So, you know, I have been working with some of my colleagues in the field of Islamophobia studies to develop an International Islamophobia Studies Research Association, or ISRA. And we're trying to do that as a transnational, international framework so that we can look at how Islamophobia exists in different contexts. So while we look at white nationalism in a lot of the Western contexts, we're looking at different kinds of ethno-nationalism. You know, we talk about China or Burma. And so we really need to understand that global landscape in order to understand even our local landscape of Islamophobia. So it's really important to make those kinds of interconnections conceptually and through research. But unfortunately, we are lacking the resources to really do that. And yet the global context is absolutely you know, it's such, it's just almost unfathomable in what's happening. And yet it's very hard to get the resources to match the urgency and the concern.
Well, I think today you've made a very strong case for the importance and significance of the issue and some practical ways in which both in the academic environment and broadly in civil society, we have to be thinking and engaging a lot more on this. And I want to thank you so much for this conversation today, but also to thank you for the important and profound work that you're doing in your research. It's so vital and significant. And I want to, again, thank you so much for that.
Thank you very much. And for the opportunity to share some of these reflections and to talk about the context of Islamophobia in Canada, I really appreciate the time and all the work you're doing with the Majlis too. This is a wonderful intervention.
Well, I want to encourage our listeners that if you're interested in Dr. Jasmine Zine's work, to look forward to the piece that's out this week in The Conversation, and to go back and look at her previous piece and look forward to her future work on the Islamophobia industry and on the study that she is about to publish, Under Siege. And also for you to get involved, if you can, practically speaking, on remembering the Quebec City massacre here on the fourth anniversary. We do need a national day of remembrance and action, so I encourage you to join that campaign. You can participate by going to www.january29.ca and looking for the hashtag #IRememberJanuary29 and contact your elected officials about the importance of declaring a national day of remembrance. Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for joining us in the Majlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Majlis.